This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
There is an utter necessity to shut down the war machine, to not stand aside, but to become directly involved and to be responsible to the forces of resistance that are currently leading the battle to defend not only Palestine, not only Lebanon, not only Yemen, but all of humanity itself.
A realistic assessment of Palestine 2 years after Al-Aqsa flood, with Charlotte Cates of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers and Samidoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. Where are the Palestinian movement and the ongoing Gaza genocide 2 years after Al-Aqsa flood? Charlotte Cates is the Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She's also the co-founder of Samidoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network and writes and speaks frequently on the Palestinian struggle and anti-imperialism. Charlotte Cates spoke on October 5, 2025 at the Institute for the Critical Study of Society, ICSSMarx.org.
I know that one of the questions that's probably foremost in everybody's mind is talking about the new so-called Trump deal or Trump plan and what that means for the future of the cause and what that means for Palestinians in Gaza now and for our collective movement. But before we move to speaking about the Trump plan in detail, I think it would be good for us to kind of look a little bit at the historical situation and the current situation that the struggle for Palestinian liberation is facing. On the one hand, today, the struggle for Palestine probably has greater international popular support than at any time in history. And I don't say these words lightly, because many times when there's a discussion about greater support than any time in the past, we are forgetting about the institutional support provided by socialist countries in the 1960s and the 1970s, the involvement of Arab revolutionary forces and Arab nationalist forces in the Palestinian liberation struggle in the same decade and before, and other critical historical developments in the struggle, which are too often left aside in modern discussions of the Palestinian cause. Even, however, beyond that point, today there are literally millions of people taking to the streets for Palestine, including in the heart of the imperial core, in the heart of those same states whose governments are responsible for the ongoing supply of weaponry and armaments to the Zionist regime, who, like the United States, directly block and veto any attempt in the United Nations to seek justice for Palestine. And even in Arab reactionary states where there is a tremendous amount of repression and normalization with the Zionist entity and extreme repression against those who speak out for Palestine and who continue to resist normalization. For example, if you saw the massive protests in Rabat, Morocco today, which were not only about corruption, but were very much about Palestine, Palestinian liberation, and normalization, there is an incredible depth of involvement in the struggle in a very broad, popular way internationally at really the Palestinian, Arab, and international levels. And it is probably greater than any time in history. And this is a support that has been brought about certainly by confronting the horrors of Zionist genocide, the Zionist imperialist genocide that has been carried out in Gaza for the past 2 years. I mean, really against the entire Palestinian people as a whole, but with the heart of the attack being that on Palestinians in Gaza, is absolutely horrific. There is no human alive who can look at the pictures of children being slaughtered, who can look at the images of hospitals being systematically destroyed, who can look at the behavior of Zionist soldiers gleefully wearing the underwear of a woman whose house they they've invaded and destroyed, or marching hundreds of doctors and health workers forced to strip down to their underwear through the rubble as they kidnap them, who can look at the images leaked from Zionist prisons where Palestinian prisoners are subjected to systematic physical, psychological, and sexual assault by Zionist prison guards, that there's no one who can look at the situation with a human conscience and be unmoved both by the horrors of what the Zionist entity and the imperialist project in this region actually is, and by the incredible bravery, resilience, and steadfastness of the Palestinian people led by their resistance forces. The red triangle, the symbol that has been used in many ways, coming from the images that were used to, that have been used in video games and in this kind of image that's being used to indicate a target, for example, that has been common in the videos put out by the Ezzedine Al-Qassam Brigade, Soraya Al-Quds, and others, has become really an international symbol of resistance to injustice and the fact that people can continue to fight back against seemingly overwhelmingly powerful enemy that is destroying humanity. So part of that broad popular support is certainly just absolute revulsion at the genocide and fierce anger at the fact that people in the imperial core in particular are being forced into direct complicity in that genocide by their governments, but also by the fact that Palestinians continue to organize, continue to resist, continue to speak out, to continue to develop an analysis, a clear vision, and anti-imperialist perspective on their struggle that resonates with the history of every struggle for justice. So when we are looking now at a death toll of nearly 70,000 Palestinians that have been confirmed by the Palestinian health ministry and by credible Palestinian NGOs and Palestinian organizations, at tens of thousands more who are missing under the rubble in Gaza, at hundreds of thousands who have been severely wounded, at children who have had their entire childhoods taken up by being in the midst of an extreme genocide, by 2 million people who are displaced from their homes. This is a horrific situation. It is a horrific situation that has been repeatedly judged, whether it's by UN experts in the special procedures or the International Commission of Inquiry, whether it's by the International Court of Justice finding there to be a reasonable case of genocide, to be very clearly a genocide. And to a certain extent, it is almost pointless to frame this as if it is some kind of a debate, when in reality, Zionist politician after Zionist politician openly declare their intent to exterminate the Palestinian people, not only in Gaza, but throughout occupied Palestine, particularly in the West Bank, where many Palestinians have been and continue to be subjected to ongoing settler assaults, and where Palestinian land is confiscated on a daily basis for the expansion of the Zionist project and the ongoing theft of Palestinian land. So the horrors of the genocide are certainly one of the things that have moved many people around the world to act. But it is not merely the horrors of the genocide that have done so, but the fact that Palestinians continue to resist. And the fact is that until the present day, there is no safe place in Gaza for occupation tanks. Despite the massive destruction that when you look at the overhead footage of Gaza, where you see buildings leveled to the ground and rubble everywhere, that resistance fighters continue to emerge from the ground, from the rubble, from the tunnels, to explode tanks, to fight off military vehicles, to defend their land against the occupation, and that these operations continue to happen from the north of Gaza and from Beit Hanun to Rafah in the south, and that there is nowhere in Gaza that their resistance is not present, despite everything that has been done to Palestinians and to the resistance over the past 2 years. When The Al-Qassam Brigades decided to launch the Al-Aqsa Flood operation. Certainly, they knew that this was going to be a very difficult challenge. It is certainly also reasonable to say that almost nobody would have anticipated the extreme extent to which the imperialist powers decided that genocide was the solution to the ongoing resistance of the Palestinian people, and the fact that Palestinians who have been locked up, subjected to siege, subjected to torture, subjected to systematic land theft, subjected to an ongoing project of liquidation of not only their cause, but their people as a whole, are going to revolt and are going to revolt not in an unorganized manner, but actually in an organized and systematic military operation that had as its primary targets military bases, intelligence offices, and the same militarized entities that surround and are called the so-called Gaza Envelope, which exist essentially to serve as a fencing off outside of the actual fence surrounding Gaza, which is denying, remembering the fact that 70% of Palestinians in Gaza are themselves Palestinian refugees who have been displaced from their homes and lands since 1948 in al-Nakba, the land to which the fighters from Gaza roamed during al-Aqsa Flood is actually the land from which they and their families have been expelled and is rightfully theirs for the past 77 years, as their right of return has been denied. However, the battle has not only been a military battle in which that has been carried out through asymmetric warfare, in which the Zionist entity and its imperialist sponsors, the United States, at the lead, but also joined by Britain, France, Canada, Germany, Italy, etc., provide essentially the latest and most advanced military surveillance and intelligence technology calculated for maximum destruction of the Palestinian people, their land, their property, and their cause, combined and confronting forces who are highly trained, highly experienced, highly creative, and who are largely relying on indigenously developed weaponry that has been and continues to be created inside the tunnels in the Gaza Strip. Today, the resistance is largely building its weaponry through using unexploded ordnance that has been dropped on Gaza over the past 2.5 years, over the past 2 years. So this is a battle which is extremely asymmetric, which is primarily a genocide, but that also has a central feature of ongoing resistance, of ongoing struggle, not just to win a ceasefire, but to seek the liberation of Palestine, to seek the return of the refugees, to seek the liberation of the prisoners, and to no longer allow the Palestinian cause to be swept from public view internationally. This is not just a war, though, that's been conducted with guns and bombs and missiles and tanks. It has also been combined with psychological warfare at multiple levels and of multiple kinds. The kind of psychological warfare which has targeted Palestinians in Gaza, has targeted Lebanon and the Lebanese resistance, has targeted Yemen, has targeted Iran, has targeted all of the forces of resistance in the region that continue to oppose and resist Zionism and imperialism, but also psychological warfare that is targeted at this growing international base of support for the Palestinian cause. Now, of course, we can see the most obvious of these types of psychological warfare attempts. They're very obvious. So you have like the misrepresentation and demonization of the resistance. The New York Times winning a Pulitzer Prize for running Screams Without Words, a completely discredited attack on the resistance, full of false claims, very clearly false claims about what happened on October 7th that was written by a former Zionist soldier. This kind of the there have been, five different documentary films and series about October 7th and Al-Aqsa Flood, all telling the Zionist narrative, when in fact, I mean, it's very clear that what would actually be quite interesting to people would be that's those same events, but from the Palestinian perspective, from the perspective of the oppressed fighters struggling for freedom, not from the perspective of those in power, domination, and control, keep it seeking to maintain and preserve that domination and control endlessly. But this kind of psychological warfare, it's very clear, it's very apparent, it's very obvious. This is just designed to essentially try to discourage, try to undermine this vast support that exists with the Palestinian cause and to push kind of the mythology of Zionism and imperialism. There are forms of psychological warfare which are combined with actual attacks by governments, for example, the kind of domestic repression we are currently seeing, but also saw under the Biden administration as well in the United States and other Western countries, the mass arrests of people in Britain for participating in protests where they say that they support Palestine action, the designation, the use of the terrorist designation to target organizations like Samidun and like Palestine Action in different countries. These are material in many ways, but they are also designed to have an effect of psychological warfare by creating terror and fear among the population in the imperial core. But there's also the form of psychological warfare which aims to instill defeat, despair, and hopelessness. And in many times, this kind of messaging takes the form of what is nominally sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, even if at the same time it is very clearly rejecting Palestinian resistance, self-determination, and meaningful sovereignty, by saying that essentially struggle is useless, everything is hopeless, and the only future that there is for Palestine is one of defeat. And this is the kind of message that we have to look out for most of all. This can take the form of, there is a lot of questionable messaging, for example, about death tolls. Many people will argue that it is genocide denial to say that approximately 70,000 Palestinians have been confirmed martyred in Gaza. However, that is the number that is confirmed and is distributed by all responsible Palestinian agencies. The fact that an Israeli researcher published a paper declaring that, in his view, the number is 10 times that number is not a valid argument to use that number. In fact, it is far from being, it is, these numbers are really questionable in a way that the numbers that the Palestinian organizations produce are not questionable. They may be incomplete, and this is why we say that it is at least this number and that many more are missing under the rubble. But the fact is that Palestinians in Gaza know each other, have produced tremendous documentation. The purpose of this kind of information and its popularization may certainly be to express outrage at the horrors, but it also runs the risk of declaring that the battle has already been lost, that the genocide is on its way to completion. And so, therefore, since the genocide is already almost completed, there is certainly no future to be found in resisting it, but only in accommodating it. And so, it is within this context of struggling against not only a physical war, but also a psychological war, that it is necessary for us at an international level who wish to build solidarity with the Palestinian cause to confront this comprehensive assault on Palestinian identity and existence and on internationalist solidarity.
على ديني على أرض تلاقيني أنا لأهلي أنا فديهم أنا دمي فلسطيني 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 أنا دمي فلسطيني.
That was Dami Falastini, or My Blood is Palestinian, by Mohammed Assaf. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Here's more from Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network co-founder Charlotte Cates on the so-called Trump Gaza Plan.
Today, the Trump plan and all of the mainstream media reporting on the Trump plan are is one of the kind of primary examples of the kind of psychological warfare we are seeing against the Palestinian cause, against the resistance, and on international solidarity. In many ways, the so-called Trump plan is a representation of what Trump said out loud in late January during the previous ceasefire before it was destroyed by the Zionists in March of this year. Other than the declaration that Palestinians will have to leave occupied Palestine and will have to leave Gaza, this was clearly a concession to bring the Arab reactionary regimes on board with the plan because they are unwilling to essentially bear the brunt of the Trump initiative and the Zionist expansion. Instead, they wish these reactionary regimes wish to find some place to benefit from it. But all of the rest of the plan, from the privatization to the theft of Palestinians' land, to the denial of Palestinian self-determination, to the attempt to create a so-called international trusteeship over Gaza that includes Trump, Tony Blair, and a number of other war criminals, to the extent to the attempt to dictate who can be part of Palestinian governance and Palestinian future. All of this is just the warmed over January pronouncements of Trump, but this time, told seriously at a press conference, first with a series of Arab and Islamic countries, all of which are allied with the United States, and secondly, at a press conference with war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu. The Trump plan created a difficult situation for the Palestinian resistance because one of the things that differentiates the Palestinian resistance, certainly from the Zionist government, certainly the Netanyahu government as well, we've seen that the Netanyahu government really does not care very much about its internal opposition. It is dedicated to preserving its own existence at the cost of the people that it claims to represent and of, kind of whipping up the most fascist forces in order to enable it to do so. The Palestinian resistance is actually very dedicated to the lives of their people. And so they view it as essentially necessary to seek an end to this genocide as soon as possible because they want to, and they view as their primary responsibility to preserve the lives of the Palestinian people, to protect their people, to serve their people. The resistance is carrying out its struggle in order to serve the Palestinian people, not to cast them aside or to view them as expendable. And so essentially, when you have these war criminals, dealing with forces that actually do make their judgments out of a concern for and a care for their people, you have another kind of asymmetry that is introduced that goes, far beyond that of the levels of missiles and levels of tanks that are available to the sides involved, That being said, and this, of course, is also the case when resistance forces, given the fact that it's not only the leadership of Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, that are based in Doha or have members in Istanbul. There are members and leaders of every Palestinian resistance faction that are outside Palestine, particularly because the Palestinian population is at least half in exile and diaspora and have been denied their right to return for the past 77 years. So when you look at the role that, for example, Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt have played, not just as mediators, but as allies of the United States, as reactionary regimes in the region, and as forces and governments pressuring the Palestinian resistance to go along with a series of so-called ceasefire initiatives that, far from bringing about a ceasefire, have mainly amounted to large-scale psychological warfare operations in which Palestinians in Gaza are told that a ceasefire is on the horizon any second now. And of course, when the Zionists have no intention of signing on to a ceasefire agreement with the objective of attempting to make Palestinians blame the resistance for the so-called failure. That there was a clear attempt to impose the so-called Trump plan on Palestinians. Now, the Palestinian resistance, led by Hamas, working in conjunction with the other Palestinian resistance factions, came up with an answer that is an attempt, and a very remarkable attempt, to essentially once again declare that they are more than willing and very eager to seek a ceasefire. They reiterated their acceptance of 2 points that they have already repeatedly stated their acceptance of. That is, number one, carrying out a complete prisoner exchange at one time, not in steps, tied to the withdrawal of the Zionist army from Gaza. And secondly, that Hamas is not going to be involved in the next stage of government in Gaza, and that this will be led by a technocratic Palestinian government, not with international supervision, leadership, or authority, but a Palestinian government. Hamas has stated these things many times before. It already agreed to these points like 10 ceasefire talks ago, all of which have been rejected by Netanyahu. And every single time that happens, the United States has come along to declare that it is, the United States has come along to declare that the resistance rejected the ceasefire. And every single time, the reality is that the Zionists have rejected the ceasefire and that the United States has fully supported them doing so, which is why the US continues to veto every resolution for a ceasefire at the United Nations. This isn't because they're seeking a ceasefire that's being opposed by the Palestinian resistance very clearly. This is because they are, in fact, the party responsible for rejecting a ceasefire over and over and over again. The response of the resistance was also quite clear. Much of the discussion has kind of settled on the idea that it's unclear whether Hamas is willing to talk about the other points in the Trump plan. The response of the resistance stated very clearly that the rest of the matters resolved are only for Palestinian internal discussion. So, whether we want to call that a rejection or whether we want to call that simply a dismissal or assigning things their proper place, what the resistance's response did was it made clear that these matters are matters for Palestinians to decide among themselves with their various political forces, with their various components of society, and not for Trump, Netanyahu, or an assortment of Arab reactionary regime leaders to impose upon the Palestinian people. In 1969, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, in its earliest days, released a document called the Strategy for the Liberation of Palestine, in which it laid out the enemy camp which the Palestinian people are fighting against. And they made clear that the enemy camp that the Palestinians are fighting is Israel, the Zionist movement, the imperialist powers led first and foremost by the United States, and the Arab reactionary regimes, with the potential inclusion of the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah alongside the Arab reactionary regimes. These are exactly the same enemy camp that the Palestinian National Liberation Movement is facing today, 50 years in the future. This is exactly the same forces that are involved in supporting the so-called Trump plan. This is exactly the same series of forces that are engaged in physical and psychological warfare against the Palestinian people, all of which are fully complicit and responsible for and may be held accountable for legally the ongoing genocide against the Palestinian people. So these negotiations are scheduled to start tomorrow and the day after. There's a lot of speculation about what's going to happen in the negotiations. These are essentially the same ceasefire negotiations that have been taking place time and time and time again. They have been taking place in Doha, they have been taking place in Cairo. The set of negotiations is taking place in Cairo, while they are not negotiations about the implementation of the Trump plan. They're negotiations on the very same issues that the Palestinian negotiating team has been representing Palestinians on throughout this entire struggle, which is limited to essentially decisions about ending this war and attempting to end this war because you're facing a genocidal enemy that really has no interest in ending the war as such. And so those are decisions about a prisoner exchange, decisions about a ceasefire, decisions about the immediate next stage of government, decisions about reconstruction. These are not decisions about the future of the Palestinian cause, but allowing for international guardianship over Gaza. These issues are not even on the agenda, no matter what kind of grandiose pronouncements Donald Trump might make in his latest press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu. These are the same topics that what's happened is that the Zionists have repeatedly, with US sponsorship, walked away from the negotiating table about. Now, of course, it's very clear, and I think it's very clear to the Palestinian resistance as well, that Trump and Netanyahu, US imperialism and Zionism can never be trusted. Everybody can look back very clearly several months ago to June 13th, while the United States claimed that it was eagerly pursuing negotiations with Iran in Oman, and at the same time was fully working alongside the Zionist regime to launch a series of attacks on Iran. Now, Iran, of course, is a developed major power in the region, which has state power, is not an occupied country, and has the capacity to defend itself strongly and was able to do so. That is not what was anticipated out of the surprise attack on Iran. They had much higher hopes for that than what actually took place in the 12 days that occurred, and in fact had to retreat just as they've had to retreat on the in Yemen as well. But when we look at these negotiations, I think the question comes, especially for all of us internationally, is what is our role in relation to all of this? It's not merely to look at the negotiations, to speculate on them, or to assess the performance of the Palestinian negotiating team. It is very much our role to do everything that we can to ensure that it is very clear that there has not been a single cessation of bombing in Gaza. That every time that Trump has come out and thanked the Israelis for stopping bombing Gaza, the north of Gaza is resonating with bombs on an ongoing basis. The massacres are continuing. There has been no ceasefire whatsoever. There has been no change in the admission of aid. There has been no change in the situation whatsoever. And so it's critical for us to continue this mass momentum that we have seen, particularly in the past days, in response to the attack on the Global Samud Flotilla, in response to the ongoing genocide, where we have seen millions in the streets in Spain, millions in the streets in Italy, many, many across the United States in the series of demonstrations yesterday. And of course, as we approach the anniversary of October 7th, to not allow the anniversary of this historic revolutionary moment for the Palestinian cause to be turned into only a moment of disaster and devastation, but to remain what it is, which is a symbol of the possibility of the Palestinian people to obtain their liberation up through struggle and through alliance with the other forces of resistance in the region, and to build for the liberation of Palestine. And so it becomes our responsibility to put first the struggle against imperialism. For those of us in the United States, to struggle against the so-called Trump plan, to struggle against all of the efforts to, whether this is the ongoing flow of weaponry or this latest initiative called the Trump plan, to confront our own reactionary bourgeois ruling class, the center of imperialism in the world, which is the force that is responsible for the death and devastation being imposed upon the Palestinian people as a whole. Now, one thing that might have been noticeable to everybody is that after the so-called Trump plan was announced, what we saw was every single European country and head of state, Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, affirming the Trump plan and calling on Hamas and the Palestinian resistance to accept the so-called Trump plan, calling it a peace plan, even though there's nothing in other than the points about withdrawal, prisoner exchange, completing and reconstruction of Gaza. There's nothing in there that's about peace. Everything is about ongoing destruction, devastation, and genocide, and demanding that Palestinians accept it. Now, these same forces, just a few days before, were talking about recognition of a Palestinian state, but the so-called Trump plan in Trump's press conference with Netanyahu explicitly rejected the recognition of a Palestinian state quite clearly. Now, of course, there have been various representatives of reactionary Arab regimes who have come out to say, well, this isn't what we expected. Also, of Pakistan and of Turkey to come out and say, oh, this wasn't what we expected. We thought we had one set of agreements with Trump. We thought it included Palestinian statehood. And so they've kind of attempted to disclaim responsibility while continuing to sponsor the project after a series of documented alterations were made to the document in meetings with Ron Dermer, the Zionist ambassador to Washington, and Benjamin Netanyahu. But this is because the United States and Israel are operating not as parties negotiating with one another, but as one force, as one entity, with one series of decisions, essentially, to which the Palestinian cause is viewed as an existential threat and something that cannot be accommodated within the future of U.S. imperialism. We saw all these same European states and as well as Canada, Australia, et cetera, all of whom had publicly announced their support and alleged recognition of Palestine as a state just days before. And this included the passing of the United Nations, of the so-called New York Declaration, which was a Saudi-French initiative, allegedly seeking a so-called two-state solution in Palestine. This included these kind of various recognition statements, and they had many things in common with the Trump plan. But one of the things about their eager endorsements of the Trump Netanyahu initiative is it did expose the reality of what these forces were actually talking about when they claimed that they were seeking recognition of a Palestinian state and a so-called two-state solution. If you read the documents that were released by the Canadian government, the French, the British, the Australians, most of the other countries involved, they did not recognize any particular land, territory, or borders as belonging to the so-called state of Palestine that they were recognizing. They explicitly demanded that this so-called Palestinian state, and I'm referring to it as a so-called state because in order for the term state to have meaning, it must have sovereignty over its borders, over its land, over its development, over its economy, and certainly over its right to defend itself. And all of these required that the so-called Palestinian state must be demilitarized at the same time that the Zionist regime remains a nuclear-armed enemy that is occupying its land on an ongoing and daily basis. This included explicit admonitions, for example, in the Canadian so-called recognition of a Palestinian state, that the next set of that there must be new elections held by the Palestinian Authority, and that these new elections must explicitly exclude Hamas and Palestinian resistance factions. So essentially, they're requiring that the so-called Palestinian state that they claim to seek to recognize must be undemocratic by its very nature. It must reject democracy. Their definition of reform is not bringing an end to corruption or increasing democracy. It's actually imposing a new dictatorship upon the Palestinian people, which at the same time that it provides security coordination and support to the Israeli occupation has absolutely no control over its economy, its land, its resources, or its borders, or fundamentally its future. So what they're promoting instead of actual Palestinian sovereignty, self-determination, or statehood, as limited as problematic as it would be to even talk about a so-called two-state solution when the entire so-called state of Israel is based on the theft of Palestinian land, that isn't even what they're proposing. Instead, at best, they're proposing upgrading the role of the Palestinian ambassador at the United Nations while Palestinians continue to live under genocide on an ongoing basis, and in order to say essentially that there is no more a Palestinian people who are under occupation, and who retain the very clear right under international law to take up arms and engage in armed struggle to resist, but instead who are represented by a state that can determine how it will resist in accordance with the state's authority to do so. So we're looking at a model similar to what they're trying to apply in Lebanon. So whether they're using the framework of recognizing the Palestinian state, which is denounced by Netanyahu and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, or whether they're using the framework of, the carrot form of this, or they're using the stick form as embraced by Trump and Netanyahu, the outcome and the goal is the same, that is the liquidation of the Palestinian cause. And it is this set of forces that the resistance is confronting. And of course, all of these parties, whether we're talking about the so-called Trump plan, whether we're talking about the Europeans, Canadians, British, and their alleged recognition of a Palestinian state, are marketing their alleged support for Palestine. They are marketing these concessions on Palestinian rights, which they claim to be making, to their public, who are overwhelmingly sick of their role in complicity in genocide and want to see a real stand with Palestine.
This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Here's the final part of the talk titled A Realistic Assessment of Palestine 2 years after Al-Aqsa Flood, presented by Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network co-founder Charlotte Cates on October 5th, 2025.
Now, of course, we can't look at what's happening in Palestine separate from what is happening in the region as a whole, and particularly in the Arab countries. When we look at what is happening north in Lebanon, we see a situation in which the United States, as well as France, continue to, in full cooperation, in full collaboration with one another, seek to, under the guise of supporting Lebanese sovereignty, for which the United States released $285 million in support to certain sectors of the Lebanese government, what they actually want to do is use those funds solely for the purpose of targeting and disarming the Lebanese resistance, which is led by Hezbollah. The United States and France are essentially doing everything they can to attempt to foment a civil war in Lebanon. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this. The Lebanese army is one of the institutions in Lebanese society that is not divided on a sectarian basis. There are many, many members of the Lebanese army who have family members who are part of the resistance. When they are attempting to turn the army against the resistance, essentially one of the reasons why the leadership of the army in Lebanon has been very wary of getting involved in this project is because they know just how damaging it will be, not just to the army, not just to the resistance, but to the fragile national fabric that has been knitted together in Lebanon in the years following the civil war. At the same time, on a daily basis, there are assassinations, invasions, and attacks by Zionist occupation soldiers on people in the south of Lebanon. Just 2 days ago, they conducted one of their daily assassinations against two engineers that were surveying buildings in order to rebuild the homes that were destroyed by the Zionists during their war on Lebanon in September through November of 2024. They target members of the resistance, but they target engineers, they target doctors, they target families that are going back to their homes. There's an ongoing assassination campaign taking place on a daily basis inside Lebanon. There are Lebanese who have been kidnapped from inside Lebanon and taken to occupation prisons inside Palestine. There is an urgent need for if the Lebanese army is going to be developed to defend the nation of Lebanon, this would mean direct confrontation with the Zionist entity. This would mean putting an end to the ongoing series of assassinations. The resistance has made clear that it is willing to support the Lebanese army in fighting Israel and getting rid of these ongoing occupation installations on the land of Lebanon. But of course, all of this aid and support is that's coming from the United States is conditioned on attempting to destroy the resistance in Lebanon on the one hand, and also imposing essentially the US sanctions and unilateral coercive measures and so-called terrorist list on the Lebanese population by the Lebanese state. So far, they've been unable to make these dreams a reality. I mean, the Zionist attacks are ongoing on a daily basis, but I'm sure that many of you saw, we are now 1 year out from the assassinations of Syed Hassan Nasrallah and Syed Hashem Safieddine, two consecutive secretaries general of Hezbollah, great international anti-imperialist leaders who were assassinated with 82 tons and 73 tons, respectively, of US-made weapons that were dropped on where they were, killing many others in the process on the 27th of September of 2024 and the 3rd of October 2024. There were tens of thousands of people at multiple events, public events in the streets of Beirut in the past days. There was an attempt to stop supporters of Hezbollah from lighting up a rock called Rawsha Rock. It's a natural formation in Lebanon that is like very emblematic of Lebanon itself, and it's in Beirut. And there was an attempt to stop them from lighting this up with the faces of Syed Nasrallah and Safieddine, and this attempt failed. The event itself went amazingly well, but the attempt was to not only seek to disarm the resistance physically, but to seek to deny the resistance its role and centrality in Lebanon as a safeguard of the national cause and a safeguard of the nation's existence. So far, these attempts have failed, but it is certainly incumbent upon all of us who are in the imperial core to stand in solidarity and be very clear on the question of Lebanon and the resistance, because in many ways, they're seeking to do the same thing in occupied Palestine, even if the most extreme levels of bombing finally come to an end. The next step is an ongoing series of attacks, assassinations that attempt to change essentially the future of Palestinian politics and attempt to change the future of Lebanese politics as well. Similarly, we are watching the ongoing attempt to seize a large portion of southern Syria, even after, one might have expected that the Zionist regime and the imperialist forces in the region would be satisfied and happy with the fact that the former government led by Bashar al-Assad had been toppled with a very high level of Turkish involvement and support, as well as, ongoing sanctions and the roles that imperialist powers played throughout the years. The new Syrian government has repeatedly stated its willingness and desire to seek normalization with the Zionist entity. Nonetheless, the Zionist forces have simply invaded large portions of southern Syria and are essentially demanding to stay there forever and declaring that that is their intention to do so, and continue to bomb Syria on an ongoing basis, to bomb the military of the so-called New Syria, and essentially seek to, because their target in this case isn't the new government of Syria, which is more than willing to give in to its demands, it is Syria itself as an Arab country existing independently and pursuing its own development and interests. In Yemen, which has really played a remarkable and outstanding role, in which Yemen has really established itself as a new power in the region, has established itself as a force that is willing to engage in tremendous self-sacrifice in order to stand with the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian struggle, and it views the liberation of Palestine as a necessary mandate for the liberation of the region. We have been seeing attack after attack on Yemen, several recent assassination assaults, for example, the massacre of 11 members of the government of Yemen in Sana'a, the massacre of 36 journalists, similar to what we have seen in Gaza, where there have been 304 Palestinian journalists that have been systematically subjected to assassination over the past 2 years. This is the battle of the People, Armed Forces, Government, and Ansar Allah Movement of Yemen is going to be an ongoing battle, not just to defend Palestine, but to defend Yemen itself and this ongoing revolutionary project in Yemen against Zionism and imperialism, which currently views it as a rising threat to their future hegemony and domination in the region, particularly given the fact that the Yemeni armed forces have very much expressed their interest in essentially a form of warfare and self-defense that specifically focuses on the economic battle. So when they confront boats in the Red Sea and prevent them from going to the port of Eilat in Umm al-Rashrash, which has declared bankruptcy as a large in many ways as part as a result of this ongoing struggle, when they fire missiles to Ben Gurion Airport in particular, they're making it clear that they are targeting centers of economic development and sustenance of the Zionist regime, which is intimately knitted into the imperialist capitalist economy today. And they are targeting this very specifically at the same time that the Yemeni government is also very focused on internal agricultural and industrial development and capacity. So this is exactly the kind of project that we can imagine and can look at history as well as what is happening currently to see that imperialism and Zionism are going to continue to target the ongoing revolutionary project and initiative in Yemen. Now, of course, one of the things we have seen in recent days has been the fact that the assaults have not been limited to the resistance countries, to the centers of resistance, to the anti-imperialist forces in the region. Qatar, which is, of course, one of the US's leading allies, the host of Al Udeid Air Base in and has, maintains excellent relations with the United States, gifted a $400 billion plane to Donald Trump, was targeted by the Zionist entity in an attempt that failed to assassinate several leaders of Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement, in Doha after they were called together by a so-called ceasefire plan issued by the United States. So, as much as the United States has taken the position since then that it condemns this or views this as a mistake, oversaw an apology call from Benjamin Netanyahu to the Qatari Emir, all of this is really, it should be very clear that it is the US that called for that meeting in the first place, which they attempted and failed to engage in these assassinations at. The US and the Zionist entity are attempting to use the assassination policy not just to destroy the leadership of the Palestinian people, but to reconfigure what that leadership looks like by targeting those who are credible and effective leaders, and also targeting those who they know are clear on their positions on the resistance and will not concede to the demands of Zionism and imperialism. So, within this context, when we are fighting against the imperialist and Zionist forces that are carrying out a genocide, and if we are going to be not simply observers who seek to understand, but engaged participants in this struggle, it is critical more than ever that we stand openly and clearly with the resistance, that we engage in counter psychological warfare that upholds the legitimacy, and not just the legitimacy, but the power of the Palestinian struggle in the face of an unrelenting and vicious genocidal assault. And this requires also surmounting the fear and terror that is being imposed throughout the imperial core domestically. This includes the series of deportations and attacks in the United States, the use of so-called terrorist designations and material support laws, the attempt to designate organizations like Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network in the US and Canada, and Palestine Action in Britain as so-called terrorist organizations. And to make sure that all of the space that is available for expression, for organizing, for confronting directly the Zionist regime where it stands, and confronting the imperialist powers that are the motive force for its military assault and its ongoing genocide, at weapons factories and other key points of production are expanded because the Palestinian Liberation Movement has tremendous capacity. It continues to maintain its ability to fight. It continues to maintain that ability, not just after 2 years of intensified genocide, but after 77 years of an attempt to utterly destroy the Palestinian people and to eliminate them from their land. So the capacity of the Palestinian resistance remains resilient and remains strong despite the horrors. But it comes to our responsibilities to stand up and to be part of that capacity rather than seeking merely to show support to the Palestinian people in an abstract sense. There is an utter necessity to shut down the war machine, to not stand aside, but to become directly involved and to be responsible to the forces of resistance that are currently leading the battle to defend not only Palestine, not only Lebanon, not only Yemen, but all of humanity itself.
That was Charlotte Cates, Deputy Secretary General of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers and co-founder of Samidoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, speaking at the Institute for the Critical Study of Society, ICSSMarx.org, on October 5th, 2025. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.